Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
This is the Turn On The Sopranos podcast.
I'm in a waste management business. Everybody immediately assumes you're mobbed up. It's a stereotype, and it's offensive.
Hey, forget about it. And now, here's your host, the boss, Joe Caparoso.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to a very, very special episode of the Turn on the Jets podcast, where we are not going to talk about the New York Jets. We're not going to talk about the NFL. We're not even going to talk about sports. We're going to talk about The Sopranos, which I constantly reference on my Twitter, how much I love. It's been my favorite show for a long time now, and judging from some of the feedback I've gotten, and since it's the 10-year anniversary, and there's been this great Alan Sepinwall book, I decided we're just going to do a Sopranos-centric podcast. I hope you guys are interested, you enjoy it. I brought on my cousin Chris Saletti, who has contributed and written to and works at a variety of different places associated with media and popular culture. Chris, I can't even list them all through right now. We've done this in the past. It's been a couple of years, but you want to rip through them real quick before we dive in?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and thanks for having me on. I'm so excited to get into The Sopranos. But yeah, I mean, I've covered sports and movies and television at a couple different outlets. I wrote for SB Nation years back, covering the Knicks and the Jets mostly, but some other, you know, just general New York sports stuff. And then I have contributed to Turn on Jets in the past. Some of the like TOJ OGs might remember some of my content from years ago, and we also did some Knicks coverage on Turn on the Knicks for a few years there too. Now my day job has dominated more and more of my time, I've had a little less time to write about sports and movies and pop culture. But I have written a lot about movies on my own personal blog, and I was employed at a site called Audiences Everywhere for a while before that site unfortunately shuttered a year ago. Writing about movies there. So yeah, I mean, a little bit of a, you know, sports and pop culture, the two of my biggest interests for sure. And I try to write about them and talk about them as much as I possibly can. So, yeah, this is a really good, merging of your and I interests here. And you know, I'm a bit confused. You said we're not going to talk about football at all, but I mean, I just can jump right into it. I mean, my favorite episode of The Sopranos ever is the Eric Mangini episode. So, like, why? I mean, we have to talk about the Jets.
It's the greatest cameo of any Jets individual in popular culture. It's such a short scene, but Mangini.
It's very. I mean, the power he conveys as sitting at that booth in the Italian restaurant is just it's pure man genius.
The year one success going right to his head, going right on the most popular show in the entire world,
yes.
Popping into Hang with Tony Soprano. I remember when I first like watched it, like, is that Eric Mangini? And then they bring it up like a second later, and it's like, what? Yeah. Is the Jets coach really on The Sopranos right now?
It's incredible. I mean, it's actually so, in retrospect, it's so Jet-like to have their coach, their first-year coach, end up on The Sopranos. And like, it's just, it's like we just get so overwhelmed as Jet fans with like any bit of success, and like with Mangini ending up on The Sopranos, it was almost that to like the nth degree. It was just like, not only do we have this exciting new, maybe not exciting on the sideline, but like we're excited about this new you know, successful head coach we have. And, like, not only is he going to be a good coach, like, he's going to be his representative for the Jets. And he's now famous. He's on The Sopranos. And then, like, 3 years later, he's, you know, with Brett Favre is hobbling around the field, and Mangini's coaching career is just, like, in the toilet. So it was just, like, nothing encapsulates being a Jet fan almost even more than seeing Mangini show up on The Sopranos. It's just perfect.
A sad fall from grace for Mangenius.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it has to do with this recent book release, but there's been a bit of, it feels like in popular culture, there's been this sort of little Sopranos renaissance. Obviously, it's the kind of thing that I think it's a very rewatchable show. It's the kind of show you could go back and kind of go through your favorite episodes or, you know, watch the whole series through start to finish. It definitely lends itself to that. And I felt like in some of the years right after it, when shows like Mad Men and Breaking Bad came out, even The Wire to a certain extent, it was, you know, The Sopranos was out in front of all these, and it wasn't remembered quite as fondly right after. It was a great show, it was inspiration for these other shows, but, you know, it missed the mark in a lot of the later seasons. It feels dated, it wasn't that consistent, and I feel like a lot of that criticism is gradually filtered away with each passing year. I feel like it gets appreciated a little bit more, and I think, you know, I think Mad Men is a comparable show in many ways, but I think this show is going to age better than a Mad Men, than a Breaking Bad. I think The Wire is a very different show, and I think that's a whole separate discussion whether which one you think is better. I think Sopranos is certainly more rewatchable from my perspective, while The Wire might be just better maybe overall. But how do you feel, you know, now with the amount of time that's passed, how have the impressions of the show changed, and why do you feel like it is kind of getting a little more popular with each passing year, being remembered a little more fondly?
Yeah, I think the way you describe it is accurate, and I think a lot of it has to do with, well, A, look, it was so influential, and it was sort of the first of its kind, and, you know, obviously, I mean, the first other shows you mentioned as so highly influenced by The Sopranos, Mad Men and Breaking Bad. You know, The Sopranos was one of the first to put this first dramatic television shows to put somebody at the center of it that was the anti-hero. So it's this bad guy, and we know he's a bad guy, and in Tony Soprano's case, he's a criminal and he's a cheat, but we're going to center it around this guy, and we are going to, you know, sort of force the audience to endure violence and so much wrongdoing. But, you know, you find yourself as the viewer rooting for this person. And, you know, and The Sopranos is one of the first shows to do that. So I think what's happened over the years is there's been so many shows that have followed tried to follow in The Sopranos' footsteps. So, yeah, Mad Men and Breaking Bad are two of the ones that did so and were able to be really incredible shows in their own right by sort of following that formula. Now, both shows are obviously, you know, much different than The Sopranos, and they are incredible shows on you know, on their own merit. Mad Men very close to The Sopranos, and obviously there's a connection there. And writer and creator of Mad Men, Matthew Weiner, wrote and produced for David Chase and The Sopranos, starting, I believe, in season 5. And you can really see a lot of the Mad Men influence, or the Sopranos influence on Mad Men in some of Weiner's work on The Sopranos and some of the later season episodes in The Sopranos. So, the dream sequence stuff is something that David Chase had done, you know, as early as even the first and second season, but particularly something like the Kevin Finnerty stuff in season 6. You know, you start getting, you watch that, and then you watch Mad Men, and you really sort of see just from a sort of tone, you know, where the Sopranos, you know, so highly influenced Mad Men. But I think as to why the show, The Sopranos, has, you know, the reputation is sort of kind of coming back around, is because, you know, I think the way we watch TV is so different now. There's just, you know, with so many, all the platforms and streaming, and there's just so much damn TV out there that you know, you can't help but, you know, realize that there's really been a quantity over quality problem with television over the past few years. It's not that there's not good shows out there now, but there's just, you know, the Sopranos, the further we get removed from it, the more special we realize it was. I do think part of that has to do with just the amount of stuff that's out there now, you know, and the way we watch stuff with binge watching and you know, the way we consume television is so different now. But, you know, the Sopranos, you know, was really, really, groundbreaking in so many ways. So I think, yeah, I think the further we get from it, the more appreciative we become of it. And you know, like anything else, you can just dive back into it, and you know, there's just so much that you notice on second and third and fourth watches, and you know, that's not even from a plot perspective. That's from the perspective of its themes and what it's saying and the way it says it. It's just such a deep and rich show. You know, and we'll obviously get into some of that as we get more specifically into episodes and stuff. But yeah, you know, and certainly the anniversary of the finale and the fact that we're already 10 years from the last Sopranos episode airing on TV, you know, that natural anniversary sort of forced a bit of a look back. And, you know, and I think people are just, you know, with that time passing are looking back and saying, you know, yeah, like not only was Sopranos just a great show and highly influential, but now that we look back on it, nothing, you know, nothing has really come close, I think, to matching it in terms of artistic merit and you know, well, not necessarily popularity, but obviously the Sopranos.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Is insanely popular, but it's just kind of just the stand on its own the further you get from it.
This is the Overtime Podcast Network.
We'll dive into the finale specifically because what you sure. said about it being the 10-year anniversary, when we talk about, as we talk about now, let's talk about some of our best, worst episodes, best, worst seasons, and maybe some of the narratives that are accurate or not accurate about the show. I think in rewatching it, I'm always encouraged how it actually doesn't feel that dated, and it does still feel elements of it do still feel relatable despite the subject matter. That's probably a little biased from both of our perspectives in that we're Italian guys from North Jersey, and this show is about Italian guys from North Jersey. And for me,
yeah,
you know, growing up,
yeah, audience, you know,
exactly. And in growing up in North Jersey, you see a lot of, you know, locations that you're familiar with, and yep, just the general sure. sort of backdrop and environment and vibe feels right, and it feels very authentic. And that, I think, comes from David Chase, you know, growing up in North Jersey and around all these places where he shot. And, you know, I think I don't necessarily disagree with the general sentiment that there's some stretches later in the half of the series run, early in season 6 and late in season 5, that maybe aren't the best moments. I do think I was always pleasantly surprised and impressed that, you know, season 1 set the bar so high, and they found a really good way to keep the antagonist for Tony fresh in season 2 and season 3 by going through with Richie, and then you bring his sister in and make her more of a factor into the show, and then bringing yeah. Ralphie in as someone who's just like a complete force in the third and fourth season. And I feel like those first four seasons were almost pretty much like flawless. They certainly had, you know, yeah. their moments or, you know, episodes that you kind of shake your head at. And then, yeah, I think, of course, no one likes, you know, when Vito goes to New Hampshire and they have some of these episodes where I don't think it's fair to say that they're buying time, but I think they were still trying to figure out how do you give an appropriate end to every sort of ancillary character around him. And then I think I was always struck by, like, that last run of episodes, how dark it does actually get, and how quickly he goes from, you know, when he recovers from the gunshot wound and goes through the little purgatory hotel, which we've seen other shows like the Leftovers kind of do their own take on, how dark that last kind of run is, from, you know, him assisting Christopher dying to him kind of deteriorating all the relationships around him. And at the end, there's really, like, from a mafia side of it, there's kind of nobody left around him. It's just a bunch of, like, random guys who are still there. When you look back sort of on the totality of, like, the peaks and valleys of the show, what sticks out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's funny because, you know, you mentioned specifically, I think it's like the thing that comes up with everybody when they think of like the valleys of this show, or like where it got like too bloated or too, you know, we're wasting too much time, is Vito in New Hampshire. And that's like the thing that everybody talks on, is like, I don't need to spend, you know, 3-4 episodes with Vito in New Hampshire. But like, I don't know, I'm going to sit here and kind of like stand for some of the Vito in New Hampshire stuff. Like, no way am I saying that's a peak of the show, but like, there is, like, we could do a podcast on Vito in New Hampshire and it would be good. I'm just throwing that
we
out.
We make
there.
It
like,
work.
Maybe we just have to like do a separate Vito in New Hampshire podcast. Like, you know, but yeah, look, I mean, certainly the show comes out of, you know, comes out of the gate firing pretty much. I mean, the first season is just, you know, it's a perfect blend of like, of action, and also, you know, that sort of, the sort of family drama and internal drama that Tony is going through, you know, the first season is sort of where the juxtaposition of those two is sort of perfectly balanced. And because of that, that first season really moves nicely. You know, in the later seasons is where, you know, it definitely starts to sort of slow down a bit, in terms of the mob storylines. And, you know, not that stuff isn't happening, but it takes longer to happen in the later seasons. You know, and your mileage may vary on what you sort of find interesting. And that's one of the great things about this show, is that there is, you know, I wouldn't say something for everyone, but, you know, there is, whether or not you're most interested in the sort of the mob plot lines, or you're interested in, you know, Tony as a character, or Carmela as a character, or Chris Moltisanti as a character, you know, or Adriana. I mean, there's just so many, you know, different avenues the show was able to explore throughout its years. And it definitely took its time to, and went deeper into some of those other characters and other storylines as the show went on. I would say, just from like a thematic standpoint, not necessarily like plot lines or seasons or episodes, but from a thematic standpoint, you know, I always kind of found the sort of brief asides to dealing with the sort of Italian American experience a bit of the more clunky parts of The Sopranos. I mean, there's like that scene in the first season where Dr. Melfi, it's like a dinner at Dr. Melfi's house, and it's when like somebody I can't remember exactly what it was, but there's like they flip on the news and there's like somebody got arrested or something, and it was an associate of Tony's or something, and you know, it sparks this conversation with Dr. Melfi and her husband and her son about like how Italian Americans are portrayed, and the mob is such a scourge on the Italian American, you know, experience. And then you have the episode in season 4 where, you know, Paulie and Silvio are attacking a bunch of Native Americans because of Columbus Day. I always found like that to be a little bit of like the least interesting stuff. And it's not like pervasive throughout the entire series, but it was just like, you know, I don't know, of all the things The Sopranos could, you know, touches on, and all the things it sort of gets into, I was like, I always thought like the experience of the Italian American is not exactly the most fertile for the show to explore. But, you know, look, I mean, you know, the show is, it's a consistently great show. And I mean, it's, you know, it's what, how many episodes, like 86 episodes, I want to say. I mean, there's not too many in there to me that are, I would consider a bad episode of television. You know, obviously some more, you know, run of the mill or forgettable as others, but, you know, there's, you could, that's 86 or so hours of television that are pretty consistently, great across the board.
Yeah, I agree. I think, like, again, like, even the worst of this show is still pretty good and better than most of the stuff out there. You mentioned some of the Italian-American stuff, and when in reading back through this book and reading, obviously I don't remember it at the time, but, you know, people kind of complaining about how Italian-Americans were portrayed in the show and that it was fulfilling a negative stereotype. I mean, it was the kind of thing, again, as an Italian guy from New Jersey, I never really thought twice about. I know that's something that, you know, other people may feel more strongly about, but it was a it was a TV show, it was an entertaining TV show, and, you know, you put the mob, you know, obvious mob stuff aside, I think I gravitated towards it, and I know a lot of other people gravitated towards it, because you saw a lot of familiar mannerisms, faces, foods, things that just kind of felt relatable and accessible for people who grew up in this place. And again, this show had a really, really good sense of place. I think another show that we've talked about in the past, either offline or on a podcast, that does a good job of having a sense of place was like the first season of True Detective. Like, you really felt like you were like there. And even the most recent season did a much better job of this than the second season did. But with The Sopranos, like, you felt like being in those sort of, like, blah, like, suburbs of, like, north and, like, central Jersey and, you know, with the city right across the river and the swamplands and everything around the Meadowlands. Like, it had that sense of place. And, again, I, you know, even reading retroactively some of the stuff around Italians pushing back on it, again, it's just not something that, you know, would still click for me, and I'm glad it didn't impede any of the stuff that the show was pushing to do creatively. Do you remember any of that, like, during the run or, like, shortly after?
Yeah, not – I don't remember a ton of it. You know, I don't know if it was just my – it was our, the age I was at the time. I wasn't really paying attention too much to the news. I also think that, like, you know, the at the time period, it wasn't – we weren't quite at the social media and, you know, news blitz and outrage blitz that we get all the time as we are now. But yeah, I just kind of think, like, when the show addressed that stuff, it sort of was sort of – it kind of was addressing the criticisms of it, and it was trying to, like, comment on that. And I always just kind of felt that it's like – and I still feel that way now, that it's like, you know, look, the plight of Italian-Americans in this country, you know, the – is you know, not something that you know, and speaking as an Italian American myself, it's just not something that, like, is as serious as the plight of many other people of ethnicities and minorities in this country. So, you know, it always just sort of felt like it was like, you know, oh, mobsters give Italians a bad name. It felt like people needed something to, like, you know, sort of be outraged over or complain about. And so it just was never something that was all that interesting to me. I don't really remember too much of it. It seemed like a sort of vocal minority type thing, and people just trying to find something, you know, that about the show that they didn't, that, you know, that they wanted to criticize, you know, sort of more than anything.
This is the Overtime Podcast Network.
Everyone always talks about the Columbus Day episode, which is probably the least fondly remembered episode of the entire series. But even, like, the Vito, you know, parts of the episodes, there's some redeemable stuff in those episodes. It's entertaining.
It's a pretty funny episode, honestly. And I think that's what Chase is going for in an episode like that. I think he's really commenting on those criticisms of the show and kind of poking fun at it a little bit. So yeah, you can watch that episode and enjoy it. It's not a bad episode per se. It's just, you know, for me thematically, there's so much going on in this show that I think those asides about, like, the plight of aliens, there's, like, a little, it's just a little, you know, it seems a bit like filler to me.
Yeah, I agree. So let's talk finale. I think one of the interesting, most interesting things in the book is sort of, Chase basically slips and says that originally the finale was going to be him driving into New York for a meeting with Johnny Sack, and he just kind of drives into the light and it ends, and he seems to slip and refer to it as a death scene. And they kind of catch him right in it, and he dances around it and says, well, that's ultimately not what I ended up doing. I wanted to go to something more ambiguous, which just hints that you could die at any moment. I think, you know, looking back at the finale and at the last episode, I remember, like many, watching it in real time, thinking my TV had fucked up, being like, oh, yep, God, like, what happened here? And then I remember being a little sour about it, and then everyone is writing all these expansive theories about why he definitely died, why he definitely didn't die. I don't know if there is an answer. I don't think it matters if there is an answer. I think whether Chase wants to admit it or not, he achieved part of what he was going for, in that he made something very unique and ambiguous that people are still debating and talking about years and years and years later. When you look at other shows that really botch their finales, I think of Lost comes to mind. That's just not remembered fondly, and people just kind of brush it off. Even if you don't feel that strongly about having some type of closure with The Sopranos ending, I feel like, much like the show, it's got more appreciated as each passing year has went on. And I think, you know, you watch it again and you read about it a little bit and you think about it, kind of it fits sort of within the overall sort of vibe of the show. And I don't know if it's any, that show is thought of any better or any different if he just gets gunned down blatantly in the diner, or, you know, it just wraps with them finishing up a meal in a more traditional end. I don't know what other directions they could really take it, rather than him just having sort of the as expected, he gets killed as a result of a mob war, or maybe he gets killed by someone from his past that you're not expecting. Now that I think about it, it's almost like, how else would have it ended? I don't know. Like, what were your initial impressions of it, and how have you thought about it, you know, as the years have passed?
Yeah, so definitely, you know, I, like you and everybody else, thought my TV cut out. You know, and I will say I always, in the moment, you know, you're pretty disappointed because you're just like, wow, that's it. And it, particularly the sort of confusion, because the cut to black, it's not just that people thought their TV cut out. People thought their TV cut out and they missed like the last 10 seconds of it. And so people thought for a while that they missed Tony getting killed, or the pan out of the family enjoying their last, you know, Meadow showing up and the family enjoying their dinner together. Like, people, it wasn't just that it cut out. It's that 10 seconds of black that before the credits hit, people thought their TV flipped back on right as the credits came on, and they thought they missed stuff. So that, you know, is a really challenging and really interesting decision by David Chase, not just a cut to black, but it wasn't like he cut to black for a second or two and then the credits, or cut to black and the credits are there. That 10 seconds of black screen is what really, really messed with everybody. You know, it's just such a bold and brazen choice by David Chase. It really is. You know, but I think what The Sopranos ending, you know, sort of speaks to is just like how difficult it is to end a show. I mean, it's difficult to end anything. It's difficult to end like a book, an episode of television, a movie. It's hard to end an article. It's really hard to end a television show where you've spent hours and hours and hours with these characters and with different storylines and everything. You know, it's why a lot of shows actually kind of cheat in a way. And one that comes to mind is Breaking Bad. Not in a bad way, I bring this up, but Breaking Bad kind of gave you three different endings. And it kind of, the last three episodes of Breaking Bad, each one could have acted as a finale on its own. So you have Ozymandias, which basically could have ended with Walter, you know, being there when Hank is killed, getting Hank killed, and with Jesse getting his girlfriend killed by the Nazis. And then the next episode ends with Walter in New Hampshire. I believe it was New Hampshire, Vermont. Maybe it was New Hampshire. Maybe he was like next door to Vito the whole time and he didn't know. But he's in a cabin all by himself with the Robert Forster character, who's kind of like the fixer who gets him the new ID and everything. You know, that show could have ended with him alone in the woods in this freezing cabin, because, you know, and that's like his purgatory, he's done. And then we got the actual ending of Breaking Bad, where Walter is you know, killed. So, but The Sopranos, you know, it didn't really do that. This is, you know, it's an in a very ambiguous ending, but it's the one ending the show gave us. And so I think it's aged really well, the ending. You know, and part of that is because it is just given people the opportunity to like to create their theories and say, like you said, here's why he died, here's why he didn't die. And you know, I think one of the theories I came across once that I actually really, really like and actually sort of maybe believe in a sense is the one where the cut to black is meant to represent David Chase whacking the audience. Because one of the biggest push and pulls this show always had to deal with was, you know, this show, famously, David Chase has said that you know, and it's evident when you watch the show, that the show is interested in family, it's interested in power, it's interested in masculinity, it is interested in deeper into family, mother relationships between mother and son. You know, really, that's one of the things at the core of this show is Tony's relationship with his mother. And that, even though Livia didn't, you know, live through the entire run of the show, her presence is there all the time, when Tony, you know, with Tony. So there's that. And, but you know, the show always had to give people violence and sex and the mob, plot lines. The mob plot lines were really the vehicle for Chase to explore all these things. And so, you had a subset of fans who said, you know, it's getting too boring. There's not enough people getting killed. I need more people getting killed. I need more action. I need more mob storylines. And, you know, the ending, you know, you could read it that way of Chase giving people, of course, not in an overt way, not in an obvious way, in a really, in a really clever trolling way, which is frustrating for the people for sure, but kind of giving them what they want. You know, you wanted violence, you wanted more people dead. Well, you're watching and here's a cut to black, because, you know, it's famously there's the earlier episode where, I believe it's Tony and Big Pussy, right? It could be on, I think it's Big Pussy who mentions that when you get killed, it's probably just everything goes to black. I forget exactly what episode that is, but it's earlier in the series. So there's always been that connection. You know, when people analyze the ending, the cut to black is referenced earlier in the series. So yeah, I think, like, you know, for me, the ending is really, it's really effective. It's really interesting. Obviously, you know, it's difficult and it caused a lot of confusion. And you could certainly make the case that it's, you know, that that ambiguous of an ending, you know, one where people thought they either missed the ending or because their television cut out. You could certainly make the case that that's not an effective way to end your show. And you know, while I don't necessarily agree with that, I'll you know, there's credence to that. But you know, look, we're still talking about it. As you said, we're still talking about it today, and there's still people theorizing about it today. So, you know, if art is meant to sort of challenge us to, you know, for us, it's meant for us to experience it and then interact with it and sort of see what we want to see in it, and what we want to see in it in a way tells us more about ourselves, then it's really, you know, in that sense, in an artistic sense, I think it's pretty brilliant, a pretty brilliant ending.
This is the Overtime Podcast Network.
I think it's aged well, and it came together well, and I don't think this show is ever going to be the kind of thing that had a sequel. Now we have found out there's going to be a prequel, which is really interesting. Yeah. It does sound like Breaking Bad is in fact going to do a sequel, and I actually didn't love how Breaking Bad ended. I did think it was sort of entertaining and over the top, you know, with a lot of action, which I get a lot of people liked. I really liked how Mad Men ended. I mentioned previously I wasn't crazy about how Lost ended at all, but, you know, Breaking Bad, I think that was one way to go about it, and now it sounds like there'll be some type of Netflix movie that's going to be a sequel to it. And I was always kind of wary of prequels or sort of revisiting some of these stories, but Better Call Saul has actually like changed that for me. I was kind of skeptical about that show, and that show has been way better than I expected. Now, I don't know if what The Sopranos puts together sounds like it's going to be set in the 1960s in Newark and be built around the Moltisanti's, and we'll get some appearances from a young Tony Soprano. You know, you trust it in the hands of the people who are making it, and it's great to see the sort of extended universe of content, you know, live on, because obviously you can't, you know, you do a sequel, you can't even do, you know, any other sort of additional things of around the same time frame as what happened with James Gandolfini. But it's going to be great to see sort of a new piece of content in that overall universe. I always want to go in with somewhat tempered expectations, because you know, you worry about, like you see with Star Wars or anything else, you know, things getting somewhat diluted. But considering how long it's been and how seemingly somewhat crazy David Chase is, I'm confident that this will come together and be something that is worthwhile and that Sopranos fans are going to thoroughly enjoy. What have been your thoughts on the early news that have came out around this?
Yeah, it's interesting. I do trust I trust David Chase. So that's one thing. You mentioned Better Call Saul, and the sort of the coming sequel movie to the Breaking Bad universe. Sort of in the same way, like, you know, the reason Better Call Saul works and that this movie has a chance to work is because you trust Vince Gilligan and his team. You know, it's just, you know, as long as you have people, you know, who know what they're doing, you know, you give them the benefit of the doubt. That is, you know, also, it's, you know, it's very possible that this doesn't work. And, you know, the tightrope walk with something like this film is, there's probably so many ways that it could not work, that it could turn out to be a disaster, more so than there are ways that it could turn out to be a success. You know, and I think part of it is just the expectations. Whereas the time we've had elapsed from the end of The Sopranos to when this movie comes out, you know, kind of helps. It also might hurt in a way, because it's given people time now to get excited, you know, and people might come in with warped expectations. And I mean, I think that's going to happen regardless when you know, are sort of diving back into a universe like The Sopranos. You know, I will say it's encouraging that, like I said, David Chase is involved. It's not like he, you know, somebody pitched him a prequel, sequel or something, and he like signed over the rights and said, go ahead. That would probably turn out to be an utter disaster. So at least, you know, Chase is involved. So far, the casting is interesting, for sure. Alessandro Nivola, the actor, is signed on, I believe, to play Chris Moltisanti's father. Vera Farmiga is in it as well. She's a really, really good actress. I believe John Bernthal is going to be in it. And like, John Bernthal is one of those actors that like he can show up for like 3 minutes in a movie and he makes it like 20% better. So I don't know what his role is going to be in this movie, but you know, just the fact that he's going to be in it is good. And like, John Bernthal, like he should be in stuff that is set in 1960s New Jersey. Like, it just seems right. So like, I'm really interested to see how he ends up. And then I think the other casting decision in the movie that is certainly nice, but you know, has a chance to go to sort of point to the possibilities of the movie not living up to expectations is Michael Gandolfini, James Gandolfini's son, playing a young Tony Soprano. Now, I imagine that it won't be too big of a role. I don't think the movie is like, as you said, it's supposed to focus more on the Moltisanti's. So, you know, we might get a couple passing sort of mentions of Tony and his, you know, and appearances of his son playing him. And it's certainly, like I said, it's really nice and sort of beautiful that Michael will be able to play the younger version of the character that his father, you know, became so famous for playing and played so well. What you don't want with a movie like this is just like 2 hours of fan service. So that's why I the casting of Michael Gandolfini gives me a little bit of pause, because it means that Tony's going to be in it, and you just don't want the Sopranos movie, the prequel movie, to turn into, like, you know, every 10 minutes or so, it's like, we're checking off a reference from the Sopranos to just, like, get the fans to, like, clap. You know what I mean? Oh, there's a mention of, like, of Tony, and oh, there's a mention of, oh, that's Silvio. You know what I mean? And, like, the movie will be good. Yeah, it kind of sounds silly to say, like, the movie will be good if it's a good movie. And if it's, and I trust David Chase to make a good movie. I'm actually a pretty big fan of his, the feature he made after The Sopranos wrapped up, which is called, why is the name of it escaping me right now? Not Fade Away. It's called Not Fade Away. Sorry. And James Gandolfini is in that, and he's really quite good in it. It's another period piece set in New Jersey in, I believe, the 1960s or 70s. Really, really good movie. And I, you know, I recommend it to anybody who's not seen The Sopranos. It has nothing to do with the mafia. It's not violent per se. It's based around the more of the music and rock and roll scene. Young man played by John Magaro, and James Gandolfini plays his father. You know, and so it's not a mob movie. It's not violent, but it's a really good movie. So I do trust Chase to make a good movie here. But yeah, you just kind of want to avoid, like, 2 hours of fan service. And I don't really think it will be that. But I think that's, you know, they know they're going to need to, just like David Chase always had to, like, make sure there was a good fiery mob plotline and, like, a good killing scene coming up, like, every 2, 3, 4 episodes, because he knew that, you know, we need to scratch that itch of the fan base, or else we're going to lose the fan base. I expect the movie to have a little bit of fan service in it for sure. I'm really interested to see what this movie comes up with. I mean, it's apparently set during the Newark riots, which was, you know, the race riots, that's going to be really interesting to see how Chase and his team handle that for sure. So yeah, I'm definitely excited for it.
This is the Overtime Podcast Network.
Yeah, I'm pumped too. I mean, why not, right? Going back to the world, and also exploring an interesting time and place in New Jersey should make for a good piece of content, which I'm excited to see come out.
The working title is The Many Saints of Newark, which is, like, the coolest title of a movie I've ever heard of.
Oh, yeah. Life. Definitely eye-catching. I also think, isn't there something, doesn't, like, Multisante, like, doesn't translate to Multisante means, like, many saints or something like that? Someone was tweeting me that the other day.
Yeah, right. Multisante, many saints. So, like, The Many Saints of Newark. It's just a great title. Fire title.
So before we wrap, let's talk about either sort of favorite episodes, least favorite episodes, favorite moments, least favorite moments, or we could even just do it, break it out as storylines. I think both of us, we got to go see Pine Barrens in the theater, I think it was about a year or two ago, which was awesome to see in a movie theater. And still from a standalone that anyone could watch that without even further context around the show and appreciate is probably about as good as it gets. It's also the funniest, I think, episode of the show overall. Whitecaps, which I think is the season four finale, wherever him and Carmella kind of finalize getting divorced, I think is appropriately always cited as one of the best episodes. I like how season one wraps up when he, you know, they hand off where he gets away from getting shot. He goes to suffocate his mom with a pillow. It doesn't actually happen. And then all the arrests, and everything kind of wraps up well with them having the family dinner at Vesuvio's. That is an enjoyable one that always stands out. And I think, I don't even know if there's a specific episode, but really when, like, you get into some of the season four stretches with Ralphie and he's at his full sort of, in his full element and full derangement, it really feels like the show is just, like, completely, like, humming there. What are the ones that kind of stick out for you more than anything?
Yeah, you definitely mentioned a couple. You know, look, Pine Barrens is great. It's really, like, a black comedy masterpiece. You know, and if you really, you know, the interesting thing about that episode that we sort of talked about when we watched it on the big screen about a year ago was, like, we were when you watch that episode standalone, you know, everybody remembers it for all the Christopher and Pauly scenes stuck in the woods chasing after the Russian. There's also so much more in it that you don't remember, and like, what, you know, it is one of the funniest episodes of The Sopranos ever, and a lot of the comedy is in the Christopher and Pauly stuff, like eating the frozen like ketchup pack and everything. But and then Bobby Bacala showing up in his like duck hunting gear is hysterical. Like, he's like ready to go. It's so good. But there's also like a hilarious scene outside of that main storyline where it's when Meadow realizes like just how stupid her boyfriend is because they're playing a game of Scrabble, and I forget the word that he makes. Is it like yes or yo or
as,
like
it's ass or something
as, yeah, and it's just like oblique. And she's like and she's just like, oh man, like, it's just such a funny moment. Like, her reaction is so good. So yeah, look, Pine Barrens is one of the best. I agree with you on White Caps. I mean, the fight between Tony and Carmella there, it's really like frightening to watch, honestly. It's very visceral. And it's such a I've returned to that scene a lot. Like, I'll just pull it up on YouTube because it's just really well written. I mean, the acting in it is excellent too. Like, James Gandolfini and Edie Falco, we obviously have to shout them out. You know, they're both brilliant in the whole series, but in this scene in particular, and like, but it's so like, it's actually like a weirdly funny moment too. And it's so insightful about family. Cause in that fight, both Tony and Carmella do something which is like really funny. Within the fight, they both bring up something about the other's parents. So like, you know, obviously the fight is brought about by when, you know, Tony's one mistress calls Tony's home and gets Carmella on the phone and reveals to her that not only did she have an affair with Tony, but Tony had an affair with her cousin, who was the caretaker of his mother.
With one leg.
With one leg, right. The one-legged caretaker. You know, and so when Tony first gets home and Carmella's throwing all the stuff out the window, you know, he's playing dumb as to why she could be so upset with him. And one of the things he says is he's like, you know, are you mad that I, you know, that I mentioned to your father about your mom's psoriasis? I was just trying to be honest. Like, that's hysterical. Like, obviously, Carmella's not throwing you out of the house because you made a joke about her mother's psoriasis to her father. But like, and he knows that. But like, that's just such like a specific family thing that like married couples would mention to each other, you know. And then a little bit later in the conversation, when Carmella is you know really giving it to Tony, she says, you know, I can't believe you had an affair with the caretaker. You know, I spoke to that woman on the phone about your mother, and she says, you know, about your mother's alopecia and her bowel movements, and like the way she says those two things, it's so incisive about like how a married couple operates and how family works and how like your relationships with your in-laws work. Like, it's at this like gut-wrenching moment, and she still has the time to like focus on like the intimacy of like having to talk to somebody about your mother-in-law's alopecia. Like, it's just like really incisive. So like, yeah, that episode and that scene are among the best for me. I think the episode, I believe it's episode 5 of season 1, College, also deserves a shout out because, you know, it really, honestly, you can look back on that episode as one of the most important episodes in the history of television. Because not only is The Sopranos widely regarded as one of the best shows ever, and we talked about how influential it was and how good that first season is, I think that episode is where it really like took off. Because, you know, you have, you know, in that episode, you know, we see Tony kill a guy with his bare hands. And it's really the first time we see Tony, the character, really have to do something violent by himself. And, you know, as the mob boss, you know, Tony is, you know, he's able to have some remove from having to do that stuff. I mean, he's able to like contract it out to other people. You know, you call up someone else to carry out the hit. But, you know, he's on this tour with his daughter for, you know, this college tour. And like, that is, you know, what, what a, like a rite of passage for a parent, right? And he's so clearly proud to be going on this trip with his daughter to look at colleges. And then, like, she upends it in the car by asking him straight up, are you in the mafia? And so, you know, then he's thrown off, you know, and then he comes across the person that has, you know, is obviously in witness protection, that, you know, they need to kill, you know, but, you know, it just shows like this main character, like really getting his hands dirty, literally getting his hands dirty, having to kill a guy with his bare hands. And, you know, doing that early in your show, and, you know, forcing the audience to, you know, sort of reckon with, like, okay, here's this character that we're following. He's the main character. Look at what he just did. How am I going to follow this person, and what am I going to, you know, and how challenging is this going to be? I mean, that was really just sort of groundbreaking. Yeah. So, I mean, those are some of the best episodes. I want to shout out one, another one. Cause, like, look, I have a little bit of a soft spot for Chris Moltisanti, like, who doesn't,
legend. Absolute and I want, legend.
Yeah, of course. And, but, you know, I love in season two, there's the episode, it's called D Girl, and it is the one where Chris dabbles in Hollywood, for a brief moment. And, you know, the reason I like this episode is because, you know, part of the thing with Chris Moltisanti is always that, you know, he feels like there's a ceiling on how high he can go, right? And, like, he always feels like he's just being used, and he has so much more to offer if they just give him a chance, right? And then he has this, like, aside, this opportunity to, like, get involved in, like, in Hollywood, right? And it's like, this is like a fantasy of his. And now it's like, here's the, you know, maybe I'm fed up with this mob world and I don't need this anymore, and I'm gonna take my talents to Hollywood, right? But what ends up happening there is essentially the exact same thing that happens to him always, and is that he's told mob stories aren't really big anymore, so, you know, we're not really interested, and you know, then he runs into John Favreau, and he has dinner with John Favreau, and he tells him this anecdote about, you know, about being in the mob. And he finds out later that Favreau sort of steals that idea for a screenplay after being told that mob stories aren't important anymore. So it sort of mirrors his experience in the family, is that he Chris is just such a tragic character. And that episode, you know, it really kind of drives it home. I mean, obviously so much more happens to him later on in the series, but even so early on in season two, you know, he has this little brief moment where it's like, man, I might be able to get out of here and maybe I can show my true worth in another world. I don't need to be under Tony my whole life. I don't need to be with the family. And yet he's just like kicked right back down and brought back down to earth. And it's like, I just think that's a really strong episode that maybe is one that people don't, you know, that people don't bring up often.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many, I don't know, like you said, when you rewatch it, little storylines, little moments and little plots that you forget about that just resonate and are done so well with even not the main character. And like you mentioned, the leads in this show are incredible. And I think it's a credit to Edie Falco that when you watch shows like Mad Men and Breaking Bad, nobody likes the wife in those shows. They always get the bad rap. Yeah. They're the least popular characters in the show. Not that, like, Carmela was some, like, beloved character, but there wasn't that same vibe with her, and she is just so good in that show and is able to pretty much go toe-to-toe with Gandolfini, who's just ridiculously good in that show.
Yep.
And that helps carry everything along. But, of course, all the different, you know, supporting characters and the way they went about casting them, even the, you know, from the people who are around basically every episode, Christopher, Tony, Silvio, to some of the people who have just shorter episodes, shorter runs when they go into the different worlds and they're going to get, trying to get Cleaver made and they're trying to chase down people to be in that. They always have sort of that funny, fun take, in the world of Hollywood, which Christopher, you know, tries to dabble in, but always fails to dabble
yep.
in. I think that was always a funny reoccurring thing that they went back to. And, you know, there was things like that. There was Tony's gambling, which was a thing that became a bigger plot line towards the end. The show never really, didn't travel that much or didn't necessarily travel that well. I didn't necessarily love the episode where they went to Italy. It seemed like they were always best when they were, you know, right at home in New Jersey. Maybe they swing down as far as, you know, going to Atlantic City or going up, you know, into the tunnel for New York. And I actually think they handled the New York integration and introducing the different characters who came out of jail in season five really well. I think that could have been a spot where, you know, you're going to bring in three or four or five new faces who end up, one of whom ends up being sort of the main antagonist towards the end. That could have been a really clunky thing when you're turning over that many people, because by that point, you know, Ralphie's dead, Richie's dead, and you're kind of, you know, Livy is dead, and you're bringing on these new faces, and, you know, Steve Buscemi holds up really well, and I think originally they wanted to have him for two seasons, but it just kind of got written into a corner when you had to get rid of him.
Right, right.
And then, you know, the way, you know, Phil Leotardo plays out, and he gets sort of that fist pump moment at the end where he gets his head ran over thanks to the thanks to the FBI tip with who's helping Tony out. I think they did a nice job integrating that overall. So before we wrap, any thoughts on just sort of that last stretch of episodes in the last season and who the final sort of run of antagonists were to Tony?
Yeah, I mean, the show ends really strong. And I think, like, you know, Phil Leotardo and Johnny Sack are both really good characters. And I think that's one of, you know, that's one of the ways the show is, you know, one of the reasons the show, you know, was so successful in its last run is, you know, you just have really, really strong characters. You know, those two in particular stand out to me. And you know, the way the show ends is really interesting too. Not specifically the ending, but the way, you know, you sort of mentioned it early on about how, you know, it really takes its time, like, stripping down Tony's life and sort of everything around him, so that at the end of it is really nothing left. And it's sort of this, like, you know, the final season is kind of this, like, good, like, it's like a slow burn, but at the same time, you know, because we've spent so much time with Tony and with you know, with his story, there is so much to sort of strip down when the show takes the time to strip it down piece by piece, that we're able to get these moments along the way that sort of keep propelling the story forward. But if you take like a holistic overview of it, it actually takes a little bit of time to sort of happen. But you know, it's really effective so that by the end of the show, you know, the last scene, you know, we see Tony and his family. And, you know, that's, you know, again, really what I think what David Chase was interested in with this, you know, with this show. He was really interested in exploring family and family dynamics. And I mean, you know, there's almost no two bones about it. I think one of the most interesting things to look at for a fan of The Sopranos is to put on the pilot episode. And, you know, the pilot episode famously was, like, done, as all pilots, you know, really are, done, you know, kind of far in advance. And, like, James Gandolfini is, like, 50 pounds lighter than he is in episode two, because it was, like, that much time had passed, like, before they made the pilot and the show got picked up and they started shooting on, you know, the regular schedule. But, you know, the first, you know, a lot of really good work. And this shows you the level of artistry that David Chase is working on, you know. And the vision that he had and that he saw through over the course of 86 or so episodes, is that the first shot of this show, which many people may not remember, is we see Tony sitting in what we learned to be is Dr. Melfi, the waiting room to see Dr. Melfi. And he's sitting on the couch, but the shot is actually in the background, and in the foreground is like a statue, and Tony is positioned in between the legs of this, like, green bronze statue. That's the first time we see Tony. Like, that's like telling you everything you need to know about what David Chase is trying to do with this show, right? Like, because then we also pull out to reveal that it's like we see Tony looking at this statue, and it's of a woman. So the first shot of this show being of Tony in between the legs of a woman, literally like being birthed, is like that's what this show is interested in. So, you know, the way this show wraps up, you know, it has to tie up the loose ends you know, in terms of the plot lines and the mob storylines. But, you know, it does a really good job of stripping Tony down to you know, basically his bare bones at the end and leaving him basically just to reckon with his life and what he has done. And, you know, he has his family there at the end of it all. You know, whether you think it ends with him getting killed or not or whatever, the last image we see of him is looking up as Meadow is coming into the restaurant. Now, again, you know, what is your interpretation of it? Does he see her? Does he not? Is that necessarily her? Is it not? But, you know, we know that he is there with his family at the end. And because that is really what, when you look at the opening shot of this show and the closing shot of this show and the opening scene and closing scene, it tells you what the show is, what this show is about. And it's about a man who clearly had issues with his mother his entire life. And those issues helped turn him, and general just sort of family issues that turned him into a life of, you know, led him into a life of crime. And he always throughout his life of crime, you know, held his family near and dear. Now, you could certainly make the case that Tony, being the bad guy, if he really cared so much about his family, he'd get out of the business, you know. And that's fair. But at the end of the day, he always did love his kids, and you know, his relationship with Carmelo was, you know, was a hell of a roller coaster. But you know, the way the show ends and begins, just such a, you know, really, really sort of interesting. You know, it's just a sort of a really brilliant look by Chase. And yeah, I mean, it's a strong ending and a strong closing season.
Absolutely. And I think dark end in that final run of episodes, but still deeply affecting when you watch it, and more effective each time I kind of watch it back through, all the way up through, and how the finale ends. And the therapy was such a key framing device for this show and making it so much more than just a mafia show. Obviously,
yeah.
The integration of his family, but that extra layer of his relationship with Dr. Melfi, which kind of serves as the backbone and is one of these things that really distinguishes this show and takes it to the next level. And that runs all the way up through basically the end of the last episode, when she finally realizes that he's really just using the therapy to kind of sharpen up his criminal skills and not, you know, kind of play off his sociopathic tendencies. It's not necessarily treating him in any way, but they did a really good job keeping that relationship somewhat interesting and somewhat relevant throughout the entire really full 6.5-7 seasons, which is not an easy thing to do with a patient, you know, therapy relationship. And like you said, that is exactly where the show starts and informs so much of his decision making and gives us more insight into why he is the person that he is and why he needed to end up in therapy in the first place. All right.
Right.
We hit a solid hour. Chris, appreciate it. Everyone follow him on Twitter at Chris Saletti. Appreciate you joining us for some extended Sopranos talk. We'll have to do it at some other point down the road on some other just more general television and movies.
Absolutely, yeah. Oh, we should mention too this before we go, like just the amazing timing of this podcast too. Given that we just had the Oscars last week and Green Book wins Best Picture, and I don't have thoughts about Green Book. I've yet to see Green Book. I know everybody has thoughts about Green Book. But the connection with The Sopranos, which some people probably know, but maybe some people don't, is the Viggo Mortensen character in Green Book, he is playing the real-life Tony Lip. Now, Tony Lip was a man from the Bronx who then got a job driving Don Shirley around the South. Tony Lip ended up in The Sopranos as Carmine Lupertazzi. And Tony Lip's son, Nick Vallelonga, is the one who wrote Green Book. So there is a amazing connection, current connection between the recently crowned Best Picture Green Book and The Sopranos, a real life connection that absolutely needed to be shouted out. And also too, Lady Gaga appears very briefly in an episode of The Sopranos as one of AJ Soprano's, you know, friends. I think it's when they're vandalizing the school pool or something. So some connections that, you know, we needed to shout out.
Absolutely. I did not know the first one. I did know the second one from the recent book I had just read, but good deep connection on the first one. There you go.
Yeah.
Little Carmine. Yeah. Always had something just a little off to say that made it funny because he had no idea how to properly speak.
yeah, absolutely.
Always found a way around it. All right, Chris, thanks. We'll talk again soon, buddy.
Sounds good, man. Thanks for having me on.